Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
James Corbett of the Corbett Report has recently put together some videos on a few 9/11 suspects. Today I'm going to share two of these with you. The first one is about 9/11 suspect and former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani. And the second one is about 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow, who wrote the outline for the 9/11 Commission report before the commissioners had even met. So let's begin first with 9/11 suspect Rudy Giuliani. And here's James Corbett of the Corbett Report.
After stepping down as mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani tried to launch himself as a national political leader on the back of the single defining event of his career.
September 11th, September 11th. Terrorists or terrorism, September 11th. The flames of hell emanating from those buildings. September 11th, fallen towers of the World Trade Center. Terrorists, September 11th, 2001.
In the end, he failed miserably, with voters immediately seeing his ploy for what it was. Base political pandering.
9/11 was bad.
I agree with that.
God, I can't believe how easy this is.
But what many do not realize is that Giuliani's case is not just that of another ghoulish politician parading on the corpses of those who died on his watch for his own political gain. On the day of 9/11, while the remains of the Twin Towers and World Trade Center 7 were still smoldering, one of Mayor Giuliani's first concerns was clearing away the evidence from the crime scene.
We were able to move 120 dump trucks out of the city last night, which will give you a sense of the work that was done overnight.
It's wild out here. They just keep coming. Look. It doesn't stop. There's more. I keep thinking it's at the end, and it's not.
Despite reassurances that the rapid removal of the evidence from Ground Zero was important for emergency access, this process went far beyond merely clearing a path for rescue workers. As Eric Lawyer, founder of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, points out, the massive operation to haul away over 1.5 million tons of debris and to sell much of the steel to Chinese firm Bao Steel at discount prices was not just an overzealous approach to clearing the area, but was itself a crime.
9/11 was the greatest loss of life and property damage in U.S. fire history. This should have been the most protected, preserved, over-tested, and thorough investigation of a crime scene in world history. Sadly, it was not. What was it? Well, we know from their own admission, the majority of the evidence was destroyed. I, like Richard said, 22 years of experience, I've seen a lot of crime scenes, I've never seen anything like this in my life. I was out at the site, I saw trucks leaving faster than, you know, anywhere I've ever seen, but I accepted it at the time, and for years I accepted it because it was a recovery and rescue operation, and that's normal to have something like that going. Again, we never seen anything like it, but that was expected. What I didn't know for years, what was going on behind the scenes, was that evidence was being destroyed when it was shipped off. By their own admission, Tower 7 investigation, this investigation at Tower 7 had no physical evidence. How do you investigate a crime when you've destroyed all the evidence? It doesn't make sense. They also admit that they refused to test the explosives or to test for explosives or residue of thermite. Now, this is what I'm going to go into here just real quickly, is there are national standards for an investigation. That's what all of us are asking for, an investigation that follows national standards and holds people accountable.
Needless to say, an investigation of the 9/11 crime scene following the national investigation standards has never been conducted and never will be, as Giuliani oversaw the illegal destruction of the evidence itself. To add insult to this injury, in 2003, New York City medical examiner Charles Hirsch revealed that in the mad scramble to get rid of the crime scene evidence, human remains from the World Trade Center had been left at the Fresh Kills landfill, where the debris was sorted and the steel was sold. In 2007, Eric Beck, a senior supervisor of the recycling facility that sifted the debris, admitted that some of those human remains ended up in a mixture that was used to pave roads and fill potholes in New York City. But as grotesque as such revelations are, they are not the most shocking part of Giuliani's 9/11 story. In the late 1990s, the mayor oversaw the creation of a state-of-the-art $13 million emergency command center to coordinate the city's disaster recovery and response efforts. Located on the 23rd floor of World Trade Center Building 7, just across Vesey Street from the Twin Towers, the center, dubbed by local press at the time as Giuliani's Bunker, included reinforced, bulletproof, and bomb-resistant walls, its own air supply and water tank, beds, showers to accommodate 30 people, and three backup generators. It could be used to monitor all of New York's emergency communications frequencies and was staffed 24 hours a day. And yet, remarkably, on the morning of 9/11, neither Mayor Giuliani nor any other city personnel or police or fire department officials were in the bunker after the Twin Tower strikes.
As I told you guys before, it's very funny. I was on my way to work and traffic was excellent. I received a call that a small Cessna had hit the World Trade Center. And I was asked to go and man the Office of Emergency Management. Upon arriving into the OEM EOC, we noticed that everybody was gone. I saw coffee that was on a desk. Still, the smoke was still coming off the coffee. I saw half-eaten sandwiches.
And as a sidebar comment, you just heard the late Barry Jennings speaking. He died mysteriously in 2008, right before NIST released their report on the collapse of World Trade Center 7. And now back to James Corbett.
So why wasn't the mayor and the city's emergency personnel in the location that had been purpose-built for just such an event? According to Giuliani, they had been told to evacuate because they had been given a warning that the Twin Towers were going to collapse. A warning that was evidently not passed on to any of the emergency personnel that were still working in the buildings.
I went down to the scene and we set up headquarters at 75 Barclay Street, which was right there with the police commissioner, the fire commissioner, the head of emergency management. And we were operating out of there when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. And it did collapse before we could actually get out of the building. So we were trapped in the building for 10, 15 minutes and finally found an exit and got out, walked north, and took a lot of people with us.
Giuliani, in his own words, has admitted that he was warned that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. This despite the fact that there was no possible way for this to be predicted in the first hour of the unfolding disaster. Even more incredibly, despite being given this warning, no effort was made to pass it on to the police, firefighters, and other responders who were still working in and around the buildings. When precisely was this warning given, and by whom? Why, despite acting on this warning himself, did Giuliani make no effort to pass the warning on to others? Predictably, when confronted with these questions by activists during his 2008 presidential campaign, Giuliani merely smiled and denied that he had ever received such a warning.
You reported to Peter Jennings that on 9/11 that World Trade, the towers were going to collapse, and no steel structure in history has ever collapsed due to a fire. How come the people in the buildings weren't notified, and who else knew about this, and how do you sleep at night?
Ma'am, I didn't know that the towers were going to collapse.
He reported it to Peter Jennings.
Peter Jennings on ABC and video, also, you indeed said that the towers, you were notified the towers were going to collapse while you were in some, not sure exactly where you were prior to, but you said on ABC video with Peter Jennings in an interview that you were aware that towers were going to collapse in advance. We'd like to know who told you the towers were going to collapse in advance, sir, and also we'd like to know who else you told.
Well, the fact is that I didn't realize the towers would collapse. I never realized that.
So where was the mayor on 9/11? On Pier 92, which was already set up as a functional command center due to a full-scale emergency drill by FEMA that, by a remarkable coincidence, had been scheduled for the following day.
And we selected Pier 92 as our command center.
And the reason Pier 92 was selected as the command center was because on the next day, on September 12th, Pier 92 was going to have a drill. It had hundreds of people here from FEMA, from the federal government, from the state emergency management office, and they were getting ready for a drill for biochemical attack. So that was going to be the place they were going to have the drill. The equipment was already there. So we were able to establish a command center there within 3 days that was 2.5 to 3 times bigger than the command center that we had lost at 7 World Trade Center. And it was from there that the rest of the search and rescue effort was completed.
Mayor Giuliani oversaw the illegal destruction of the 9/11 crime scene and is criminally liable for the deaths of hundreds of emergency workers for not passing on prior warnings about the collapses of the Twin Towers. It is no wonder, then, that the Fire Department of New York so passionately detests Giuliani for his actions in disgracing their fallen brothers and covering up the 9/11 crime.
Rudy Giuliani has used the horrible events of September 11, 2001, to create a carefully crafted persona. But the fact is, what Rudy portrays is not a full picture of the decisions made that led, in our view, to the unnecessary deaths of our FDNY members and the attempt to stop the dignified recovery of those lost. The urban legend of America's mayor needs to be balanced by the truth.
So what is the reward for Giuliani's criminal actions on 9/11? An offer to become the head of the Department of Homeland Security in the event of a Trump presidency, of course. This is the state of American politics, and this is precisely why a true investigation of what happened on 9/11 never has, and never will, be conducted by the U.S. government itself.
And now you'll hear James Corbett talk about 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow.
It took President Bush an extraordinary 441 days after 9/11 to establish a commission to investigate the events of September 11, 2001. And it was not just the case that Bush was slow in acting. He actively resisted any investigation for as long as he could, taking the extraordinary and unprecedented step of personally asking Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to limit Congress's investigation into those events. In the end, the commission was severely underfunded, severely rushed, and, as Commission Chairman Thomas Kane later admitted,
"We think the commission in many ways was set up to fail."
But the most unmistakable sign that Bush was only interested in appointing a cover-up commission to investigate the largest attack on U.S. soil in modern history was his initial choice for commission chairman.
"Today I'm pleased to announce my choice for commission chairman, Dr. Henry Kissinger."
"Dr. Kissinger, do you have any concerns about, once the commission begins its work, if fingers point to valuable allies, say Saudi Arabia, for example, the implications, the policy implications this could have to the United States, particularly at this delicate time?"
I have been given every assurance by the president that we should go where the facts lead us."
Not even the New York Times could believe that Henry Kissinger, the consummate Washington insider, could pretend to conduct an independent fact-finding investigation into 9/11. It is tempting to wonder if the choice of Mr. Kissinger is not a clever maneuver by the White House to contain an investigation it long opposed, the Times editorialized after the announcement. Kissinger may have been prepared for such polite disagreement with his appointment, but he was not prepared to meet the 9/11 widows whose tireless efforts had forced the creation of the commission in the first place.
"Several family members approached Kissinger and requested a meeting at his office in New York. Prior to the meeting, Kristen Breitweiser conducted a thorough investigation of Kissinger's potential conflicts of interest."
"Probably much to the chagrin of some of the people in the room, Lori asked some very pointed questions. Would you have any Saudi American clients that you would like to tell us about?" And he was very uncomfortable, kind of twisting and turning on the couch. And then she asked whether he had any clients by the name of Bin Laden. And he just about fell off his couch.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger stepped down from the position Friday.
"We thought the meeting went well."
Kissinger was dethroned, and the commission went ahead under Chairman Thomas Kane and Vice Chair Lee Hamilton. But while Kissinger's appointment and resignation received all the attention, the White House was busy slipping another agent into the commission through the back door. In January of 2003, just weeks after Kissinger stepped down, it was quietly announced that Philip D. Zelikow would take on the role of executive director. As executive director, Zelikow picked the areas of investigation, the briefing materials, the topics for hearings, the witnesses, and the lines of questioning for witnesses. In effect, this was the man in charge of running the investigation itself. So who was Philip Zelikow? The commission's press release announcing his position described him as a man of high stature who has distinguished himself as an academician, lawyer, author, and public servant. Although they noted his position at the University of Virginia and his previous role as executive director for the National Commission on Federal Electoral Reform, curiously missing from this brief bio are the multiple conflicts of interest that show how the Bush administration essentially put one of its own in charge of investigating how the Bush administration failed on 9/11. In 1995, Zelikow co-authored a book with Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice. He was part of the transition team that helped the Bush administration take over the White House from the Clinton administration. He was even a member of Bush's post-9/11 Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. But perhaps most incredibly, Zelikow actually authored the Bush administration's 2002 national security strategy that outlined the preemptive war doctrine that would be used against Iraq. This, however, is something that not even 9/11 commissioners Kane or Hamilton themselves knew at the time the commission was formed.
Zelikow was the author of a very important document issued by the White House in September 2002 that really turned military doctrine on its head and said that the United States could become involved in preemptive war, preemptive defense, that we could attack a nation that didn't pose an immediate military threat to this country. And obviously in September 2002, it sure appeared that that document was being written with one target in mind, Iraq. Now, as I say, the author of the document at the time was anonymous. We didn't know that Philip Zelikow had written this thing, and that becomes known, I think, widely on the staff only in the final months of the 9/11 Commission investigation, and it appeared to pose yet another conflict of interest for Zelikow.
Just to be clear, the preemptive doctrine memo comes out in September of 2002. The commission is created formally in
December 2002.
Do Kane and Hamilton, when they hire Zelikow, are they aware of his role as the author of the preemptive doctrine?
I don't believe so.
These conflicts of interest were not merely theoretical. After the victim's family members discovered Zelikow's links to the Bush administration, he was forced to recuse himself from the proceedings of the commission, which he himself was directing, that had to do with the Bush White House transition or the National Security Council. Hearing of Zelikow's appointment, former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, who Zelikow helped to demote during the Bush transition, remarked that the fix is in, wondering aloud, could anyone have a more obvious conflict of interest than Zelikow? Key staffers and even one of the commissioners threatened to quit the commission altogether when learning of Zelikow's history. When the 9/11 victims' family members discovered Zelikow's links, they protested his appointment, but unlike with Kissinger, this time, their concerns were dismissed, and Zelikow plowed ahead. As even Zelikow himself admits, his ties to the very figures he was supposedly investigating are a legitimate concern, and any real investigation of the 9/11 cover-up would begin with him.
There's a whole welter of conspiracy theories about 9/11 floating around the internet, in video cassettes, and there's a whole cottage industry in this, which if you haven't read much about it, then you're a fortunate person. I get a lot of this. I actually figure very largely in a number of the key conspiracy theories. But be fair, I worked with Condi Rice, right? I worked with her in the administration of Bush 41. I could be read as the plausible henchman executing the cover-up. It's a legitimate concern, especially if I hadn't had 81 other staffers keeping their eagle eye on me.
Conveniently left out of Zelikow's story about the 81 staffers keeping their eye on his decisions is that they were staffers who were hired by him and under his complete control. In fact, Zelikow took over the hiring of the commission staff and even stopped staffers from communicating directly with the commissioners themselves. In the first few months, the 9/11 commissioners themselves rarely even visited the commission because Zelikow denied them their own offices or the ability to hire their own staffers. The most remarkable example of Zelikow's dictatorial control came in March 2003, just 3 months after the commission's 16-month investigation began. It was at that time, before the commission had even convened a single hearing, that Zelikow, along with longtime associate and commission consultant Ernest May, co-wrote a complete outline of the final report.
Before the staff even had its first meeting, Zelikow had written, along with his former professor Ernest May, a detailed outline of the commission's report, complete, as Sheenan put it, with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings. When Kane and Hamilton were later shown this outline, they worried that it would be seen as evidence that the report's outcome had been predetermined. So the three of them decided to keep it a secret from the rest of the staff. When the staff did finally learn about this outline a year later, they were alarmed. Some of them circulated a parody entitled "The Warren Commission Report, Preemptive Outline." One of his chapter headings read, "Single bullet, we haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure." The implication was that the crucial chapter in the Zelikow May outline could have been headed, "Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, we haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure."
So what exactly did Zelikow do as executive director? He allowed information in the commission's final report derived from illegal CIA torture sessions, despite not having access to the evidence of those sessions themselves, which were later illegally destroyed. This included the testimony of alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times in a single month, whose children were kidnapped by the CIA, who was told that his children were going to be tortured with insects, and who eventually confessed to a whole series of plots, including bombing a bank that didn't exist at the time he was arrested. More than one quarter of the footnotes in the final commission report source from this torture testimony, and as Zelikow himself admitted, quite a bit, if not most, of the commission's information on the 9/11 plot itself came from this testimony. Zelikow denied interviews and documents to staffers investigating the Saudi connection to the attacks, eventually firing one of them and removing the text of their investigation from the final report. He personally rewrote a commission staff statement to suggest a systematic link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq before 9/11, outraging the authors of the original statement. He worked behind his own staffers' back to stop them from serving the Pentagon a subpoena to answer about information NORAD was withholding from the commission. He sat on a proposal to open a criminal investigation into FAA and military officials who lied to the commission for months, and then forwarded that proposal not to the Justice Department, who could have brought criminal charges, but to the Inspector General, who could not. And he covered up information on Able Danger, a military intelligence team that had identified several of the alleged 9/11 hijackers in the country before 9/11.
After the initial disclosure, Dr. Zelikow came to me at the end of the meeting, gave me his card and said, "What you said today is critically important, very important. Please come see me when you return to Washington, D.C. I returned to Washington, D.C., January of 2004. Call in. They say, "We want to see you. Stand by." Nothing happens. A week goes by. I call again. They say, "We don't need you to come in. We have all the information on Able Danger we need. Thank you anyway." And that was where it ended.
All right, so the information that you told Dr. Zelikow in Afghanistan about the CIA interfering with your ability to provide actionable intelligence to the United States government, intelligence that might have helped them find out who caused 9/11, you were not permitted to testify about.
That's correct.
Okay.
From the initial outline to the final report, Zelikow carefully guided the process, hiring and firing the staff, directing their research efforts, deciding on witnesses, scrubbing information, and shielding his former colleagues in the White House from criticism. But perhaps more remarkable than the fact that the fix was in from the moment he took over the commission and began working on the predictive outline of the final report is that he had in fact written about 9/11 and its eventual aftermath in 1998, 3 years before September 11th. In an article entitled Catastrophic Terrorism, Tackling the New Danger, written for the Council on Foreign Relations Foreign Affairs in November 1998, Zelikow and co-authors Ashton Carter and John Deutsch ask readers to imagine a catastrophic act of terrorism like the destruction of the World Trade Center. Like Pearl Harbor, the event would divide our past and future into a before and after. The United States might respond with draconian measures scaling back civil liberties, allowing wider surveillance of citizens, detention of suspects, and use of deadly force. More violence could follow, either future terrorist attacks or U.S. counterattacks. Belatedly, Americans would judge their leaders negligent for not addressing terrorism more urgently. Zelikow's amazing prediction becomes somewhat less remarkable when we learn his own self-described expertise in the creation and management of public myth. In a separate 1998 article on public myths, Zelikow identifies generational myths that are formed by those pivotal events that become etched in the minds of those who have lived through them, before noting that the current set of public myths, formed during the New Deal in 1933, are currently fading. Convenient for Zelikow, then, that the Pearl Harbor event that would define the next generational myth, known as the War on Terror, would arrive just 3 years later, and that he would be in charge of the commission tasked with creating and managing the public perception of that myth. Indeed, given his central role in the cover-up of 9/11 and deflecting concern away from legitimate 9/11 suspects, any true investigation into the events of September 11th would involve a thorough interrogation of Philip D. Zelikow.
And again, you were just listening to James Corbett of The Corbett Report, sharing two of his reports on 9/11 suspects Rudy Giuliani and Philip Zelikow. To see the videos of these reports, go to CorbettReport.com, and I think they're also on YouTube. And just a reminder that 9/11 wake-up call shows are archived at RadioForAll.net, and that's the digit four, so RadioForAll.net. Once on the site, click on Contributors, and then on Cheryl, under the letter C, and the show should pop up in chronological order. 9/11 Wake Up Call airs at WWUH on Wednesdays at noon and 8 p.m., and on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. at WESU-FM. You can also catch the shows by going to noliesradio.org, and they are also intermittently aired at the radio station at Boston College, sometime on Sundays between 6 and 10 a.m. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Power to the people.